Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, science, and healthcare in the news, debate, discussion, dialogue, and answers to your questions via email and phone calls, all here on Ask Dr. Dawn. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Our first email is from Avery in Hawaii, and Avery writes, "My cousin was recently diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. She read that she should go on a vegan diet. After she did, she had to go to the hospital with pain from the inflammation. Can you give some dietary recommendations and perhaps a good resource for treatment? I've read fish oil is good, but some information say it is bad and can cause inflammation. I listen every week and hold your opinion in high regard." Avery, first of all, I want to point you to the interview done on June 13th, 2009, originally, with Gerard Mullen, which is a discussion of inflammatory bowel disease. Both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease are covered in that. And there are some specific recommendations in terms of nutritionals and also, I think, a good general background of functional medicine thinking from a board-certified gastroenterologist, so a man who has one foot in both worlds like myself. With respect to just the Cliff's Note version of that, I'm intrigued with the fact that she went on a vegan diet and then got worse. And I'm wondering if that doesn't suggest that one of the components in the vegan diet might have aggravated her condition. And of course, the top one on the list that crosses my mind is wheat. Because of course, if a person is eating a vegetarian diet and avoiding all animal products, they tend to have a diet that's fairly wheat heavy. And wheat is, in many people with ulcerative colitis, inflammatory. Let's put it that way. They don't specifically have celiac disease, but they have developed antibodies against wheat, which can be found in their blood if you look for them. So it's an established thing. And I think it's pretty significant that she made a dietary change and got worse. And so I would suggest that she get IgG, not IgE testing, for common food antigens and see if indeed she does have reactivities, would be foods that she needs to avoid at least for 6 months. Other things, use of omega-3 fatty acids at about 2,000 milligrams. If you want to do flaxseed because you want to be a vegetarian or a vegan about it, you're going to need to multiply that by 5, so that would be 10,000 milligrams. And I'm not sure how many cc's or tablespoons of flaxseed oil that would be, but it's probably an amount that you could consume reasonably if you figured out how to make it palatable. Once your cousin is in remission, then the use of high-dose probiotics to prevent recurrence is advisable. There are authorities, and this is discussed on that interview that I mentioned, there are authorities who think that because during an acute attack of ulcerative colitis, you have sores on the inside of your intestine, that it would be possible for bacteria to get into your bloodstream and that therefore high-dose probiotics might be a contraindication. Not a lot of data on that, but there are a couple of case reports of people showing up with probiotics on blood culture, which clearly establishes that it can happen. Herbs and nutraceuticals, both Boswellia and curcumin. Boswellia, by the way, is frankincense, which, you know, you think about Christmas and gold frankincense and myrrh. And I love the idea that one of the most valuable commodities in the ancient world was actually an anti-inflammatory compound. Anyway, Boswellia and curcumin are both anti-inflammatories that can be very useful even in acute ulcerative colitis to help calm that down. And yes, sometimes you do need to use steroids to reduce an acute attack, just like there are certain times when you're really glad you have the heavy pharmaceuticals at your disposal. But in the long run, the heavy pharmaceuticals are not my first go-to place, for example, for maintaining remission in a colitis. Our next email is from Glenna in Paso Robles, wondering about rosacea inside nostrils. I visited my eye doctor yesterday, says Glenna, and she looked at my face and suggested that the newish problems I'm having with my contact lenses gunking up, parenthetically, this is the same material in the contact lenses that I've worn for years, might be ocular rosacea. Her recommendation was omega-3 fatty acids, which I've started, and as far as I know, there's no accepted treatment. But this has raised a question for me that's been brewing for a while. Since moving to Paso Robles 5 years ago, I've been plagued with what I thought was just my nose reacting to a drier climate than I've ever lived in before. Persistent scabs in my nostrils that collect material and are hard to leave alone and which break open in my nose with a big smile, etc., worse in summer. Now I'm wondering if it's possible to have rosacea inside the nose. And, you know, Glenna, the answer to an is it possible question is always yes, but it's certainly unusual, as for that matter is ocular rosacea. So that would make me want to think in terms of maybe you have, you know, some upregulated inflammatory genes in your body or something going on like that. The first thing I would do as a medical doctor when confronted with sores in the nose is culture that and see if the person is colonized with methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, which has become fairly common. And about 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, actually, now that I think of it, was when I first started seeing it. Now it's out there in the non-sick community, and it is something that can cause that condition. The use of moisturizing agents or lubricant agents, even just simple Vaseline or Crisco in the nose at night, is very helpful if it's just dryness. And so I wanted to point you in that direction. There are also a number of nasal lavage products that people use with neti pots to wipe out allergic antigens. And it is possible that you could have a dust allergy or something that's leading to irritation and itching. And then the itching leads to scratching and then superinfection and the whole thing that you're talking about. So hope you find that helpful. One last email, this one quite timely. This is from Judy in Santa Cruz, wondering about influenza vaccine. Is a chemical used in the flu vaccine that increases a person's response to the dead virus? If so, could some people be highly sensitive to this chemical? So, Judy, I went and pulled the background on Fluzone, which is one of the influenza vaccines, just to see what was in that. And there is no adjuvant or, as you put it, a chemical that would increase a person's response. It's really just the hemagglutinin portion of the flu, and that's the, you know, H1N whatever. So this is the H component in this vaccine. With respect to your second question, could people be highly sensitive to this chemical? Yes, there are people who have a very strong response to adjuvants. In this case, it doesn't apply. But with other vaccines, particularly bacterial vaccines, where it's hard to get a good response, an adjuvant like diphtheria toxin will often be added to sort of put a big red neon light on the protein you're trying to get the immune system to react to and say, hello, immune system, check this out. In other words, upregulate the immune system so it recognizes the less antigenic compound. And yes, there are people who have really extreme reactions. We generally will get that history of a really bad reaction to tetanus toxoid or to some other vaccine. And then we know that we may need to avoid vaccination in that individual or use a much smaller dose. The other thing, is there a connection between sulfa drugs and sulfite allergies? Sulfite allergies are typically seen in asthmatics, and these are people who will wheeze. There is a cross-reactivity, it's not 100%, between sulfa drugs and sulfites. So a person with sulfite allergy is not necessarily going to have a bad reaction to, say, Sceptre or Bactrim, which are commonly used sulfa drugs, but they may, and they're at a higher risk for it. So I hope that this helps clear those things up for you. Let's go to Diana in Monterey. Hello, Diana, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. A few months ago on NBC News, they had a piece on a stroke patient who received Botox injections to help with his contracted arms, and he was able completely to use his arms again. And I asked the doctor about this in a case involving somebody with Alzheimer's, an elderly person with Alzheimer's, whose arms had been contracted for a couple of years. And the doctor said, first of all, Medicare wouldn't cover such Botox. And also, she said that it has to be a new patient, a new problem with contraction. But this patient, whenever she has a seizure, her arms completely will go straight out. So I'm wondering why the Botox wouldn't work for somebody like that.
Well, actually, that's a very good question. The reason that your doctor made that assessment about it having to be a fresh stroke is because what happens in the stroke patient is that they lose tone in one of the muscles. All of our muscles have an equal and opposite muscle. For example, when you straighten out your arm, you relax the biceps and you tighten the triceps, and that's how you straighten your arm, and vice versa. When you tighten your arm, you tighten the biceps and flexing the arm, I mean, you know, bending your elbow, and you loosen the triceps, and that's hardwired in the brain. And if you lose one of the connections, then you can't relax the opposing muscle. In the case of the body, there's a default to return to the fetal position. So we bend our hips and we bend our knees and we bend our arms. And if you kill the connection by a stroke that has the opposing muscle, the one that loosens the biceps and tightens the triceps, then you'll end up with a contracture. The use of the Botox in the biceps muscle, in other words, weakens the biceps. So now the triceps is strong enough to overcome the non-relaxing biceps. You've relaxed it manually. Over time, if a person remains in a contracted position, the tendons tend to tighten up. So the biceps tendon itself, which is not a muscle, but a relatively, I would say it's a flexible rope-like but non-stretchy structure to characterize it. So once that rope gets short, then you can't get the arm to straighten out. The fact that the person with Alzheimer's that you're referring to has seizures in which their arms extend has probably saved them from having the contracture of the tendon. And so in that individual, unlike most people with flexion contractures, the Botox might in fact work.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you can phenomenologically see the arm go out during a seizure, I would say the prognosis is much better than average for success. Now, in terms of cost and dose and duration of benefit, let's talk about that for a moment just to price tag it. Would Medicare cover it? Probably not, particularly if the person had fairly advanced Alzheimer's. So this would be something you would be doing out of pocket. The amount of Botox that would probably take to loosen an arm muscle, because it's a big muscle, is probably hundreds of units. So you figure best price for Botox is somewhere between $350 and $500 per unit wholesale. Do the math, and you're looking at maybe $1,500 in materials to get the effect. And then how long does the effect last? 3 to 6 months.
This one gentleman on the news program was getting the injection once a year.
Okay, so longer than that. I think it's just variable in terms of how long Botox lasts. Mm-hmm. Its action is to block the release of the neurotransmitter to the muscle. The nerve endings grow back and regrow their vesicles and their little structures that allow them to release neurotransmitter. And how long it takes them to grow back is variable. So I think probably he had a partial weakening. He got stronger and stronger. The question really in an Alzheimer's patient is, if you loosened up the muscle, would it do them much good? Or would they still remain in the contracted position, not because of a stroke, but because that's the natural tendency of the brain as it shuts down? So it's not really clear that you'd get much benefit. And I don't know cognitively whether this person could participate in occupational therapy and derive improvement, or whether it's just really a lost cause. And I don't write people off easily, but, you know, we do have to be realistic that sometimes there just isn't enough benefit to be worth a financial cost like that.
I'll be frank with you. They wouldn't be able to do anything, but I was thinking of the person taking care of her. It would be easier for getting dressed and all that. That was my...
Yeah, I understand. There are actually, as far as getting dressed goes, there are specialty garments that are made for people with strokes and contractures that have like Velcro along the seams and things that work quite well.
Yeah.
So you may want to think about, you know, how can we make some garments that will work better for the caregiver? That'll be a lot cheaper.
Yeah, you're right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. And let's talk to Amanda in Felton. Hello, Amanda, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for doing this program. It's really wonderful.
Oh, well, thank you.
So I'm wondering your thoughts on the flu shot. I know you mentioned it earlier in the program, but I've heard some people say that they don't recommend it, but I'm working in the public schools this year, and so I'm just thinking about getting it, but I was wondering what you think about it.
I think the flu shot is an excellent idea. I don't think there's a great global conspiracy to rip off the public. I would refer people to a book that was, and my producer will give me the exact date, but I want to put it out there. It was called The Great Influenza, and I did the interview with the author maybe 4 or 5 years ago. This was back around the time of the bird flu thing in Asia, where they were killing off massive flocks of birds because they'd had a few human fatalities, and they were seeing the potential for that virus to jump into human to human, and they wanted to nip that in the bud. Successfully, as it happens, when we had what turned out to be a swine flu outbreak in Mexico in the spring of 2009, that was also quite lethal initially in young, healthy people who had an excessive immune reaction. So we got really worried. There was a big pitch to make sure we had H1N1 stockpiled to be able to give it in large numbers to the population. Over the summer, the H1N1 virus mutated and became weaker. So there was kind of a sense of a false alarm, and that's where all the conspiracy theories came out at that point. I was so relieved last year that the virus did mutate and become less virulent, and we didn't get a huge flu outbreak. I was just, oh my God, we dodged that bullet. But a lot of people have reacted by saying, okay, well, this discredits the whole concept of vaccination for influenza, which is an uninformed overreaction, in my opinion. I do recommend flu vaccine for everyone, really, but the people who are at the highest risk are young children, so the very young and the very old. And very old, by the way, means 65 plus, so maybe that's not very old in some people's books, especially if they're 64. But from an immune system standpoint, that's where there's a jump in the number of cases of post-influenza pneumonia. And post-influenza pneumonia is the nastiest pneumonia you can get. You'll get bacteria in there like Staph aureus that never get into the lungs otherwise. But because the influenza damages the lungs and damages the immune system of the lungs, these other bacteria that are otherwise not a problem will move in, and it's a just lethal, lethal kind of pneumonia. So we really don't want people who are at risk for that getting an influenza. The middle range of people, under 65 and over 2 years of age, are probably not going to die if they get influenza. They'll probably get sick and miss a couple weeks of work or school, worst case scenario. Maybe they'll get the pneumonia, but probably won't kill them. On the other hand, missing 2 weeks of work in this economy for most of us is a big deal. And if you are going to be exposed to flu by working with the public, I think it's an excellent idea. If you're in the school system, if you have small children who are going to be coming home from school, if there's anybody elderly in your world that you might vector it to, and if you handle money. So, have I left anyone out, really? You know, with all of those potential exposures, I think we've covered just about everybody but the guy who lives in who's perched up there in Boulder Creek, telecommutes to Silicon Valley and does everything by credit card. He's probably okay. And there are people like that. So the hermits are probably safe and don't need a flu shot.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. By the way, my producer, Ever Alert, has provided me with the context for that initial digression. The book was John M. Barry's The Great Influenza, The Epic Story of the Deadliest Plague in History. And the date of the interview is February 12th, 2005. So if you want to hear more about it, you could look in the archives in Ask Dr. Dawn and then click on interviews and just scroll back to February 12, 2005. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
One more email here. This one is a little older, and I don't actually have the page that has the name of the person, but it's a question about diabetes. I'm 45 years old and have a BMI of 21. That, by the way, is a low normal healthy body weight. My fasting blood glucose is typically 115. And I have health records going back 20 years showing similar readings. This year, my new physician became concerned and suggested a 30-gram carb day diet. My two-hour postprandial readings tend to be 106 to 118. A typical low-carb meal bumps my readings up only 8 to 10 points. I don't have high glucose spikes, even with moderate carb meals, from my distant past. Given my long history of high fasting blood glucose, I'm wondering if my blood glucose irregularities might be more indicative of a slow onset autoimmune type 1 diabetes rather than type 2. Is there any way to tell the difference, and is the prevention the same? I've been following a low-carb diet since May and have seen no improvement. I've heard it sometimes takes 6 months before numbers improve. I do a lot of reading on this topic and have recently read a low-carb diet can increase fasting blood glucose and actually worsen insulin resistance. By decreasing carbohydrates, your body becomes glucose-sparing and less able to metabolize carbs. The goal of the low-carb diet is to minimize the amount of glucose and insulin in the blood. Have you heard about this glucose-sparing theory, and should I be concerned? I have heard about the glucose sparing theory, and it's a really interesting theory, but unfortunately, I would have to say it's completely unsupported by the clinical evidence and is probably true for somebody somewhere, but for the general herd of people, no. So the way you tell the difference between type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes is looking at insulin levels. Type 1 diabetes is a lack or an inadequate supply of insulin. It can develop slowly. It is an autoimmune disease. Sometimes it will develop slowly, particularly in older adults, when it does show up in them, but that again is rare. So you can measure insulin levels, and particularly something called a C-peptide is an easy to obtain test. So fasting insulin with a C-peptide level will tell you whether your insulin levels are high or low and compared to your blood sugar. If you have high insulin levels and your elevated blood sugar, then that puts you in the type 2 category. Plenty of insulin, not enough receptor response. If you have low insulin levels and a high blood sugar, that puts you in the inadequate insulin supply category. And yes, the approach would be different because in an autoimmune disease, you're seeking to downregulate the immune system as you might with rheumatoid arthritis or with some other autoimmune condition. Whereas with type 2 diabetes, too much insulin, you're seeking to lower insulin receptors to prevent further receptor burnout. If you have a high fasting blood sugar and otherwise normal blood sugars after meals, what that tells me is that you probably have a problem with your liver receptors. And if you've had that problem for 20 years without progression, then you may simply be built that way. And in your case, a high fasting blood sugar is not a problem. You are one of these outlying individuals. The way I would approach it is to get a 2-hour blood sugar. So you would have a fasting blood sugar and a fasting insulin, and then you would eat a sugar load. And then at the 2-hour mark, you would look at insulin levels and blood sugar levels. And if you start out with a high insulin level and it goes higher, then what that suggests is that you are really pre-diabetic and you need a low carbohydrate diet, even though your postprandials are fine. It says that your pancreas is good, strong pancreas, and it can churn out the insulin when it's summoned. But it does suggest that the receptors in your liver are attenuated, and that's why you're waking up with a high blood sugar. Other things that you would want to look at is family history. If there are a lot of people in your family with type 2 diabetes, that would certainly push one in the direction of continuing the preventative. So, fairly complex question, and I hope that you have found some use in the answer. I'm going to take a few moments and talk about some interesting recent research that is, if you've been a regular listener, then you know how interested I am in the topic of epigenetics, the idea that it's not just mutations in your DNA, but programmable changes in methylation and acetylation, which change the probability that a gene will be read. So not just gene mutation, but actually control on gene reading that influence the variabilities in disease and the manifestations of genetics. Well, get ready for meta-epigenetics. I'm not sure what it's actually going to be called, but that's what I'm going to call it for now. Beyond epigenetics, we have copy number variation. Because our science has finally gotten sophisticated enough to do whole genome analysis, we have found something that was pretty much unsuspected until quite recently. So let me set you up with this. Once upon a time, there were these things called chromosomes that were thought to be associated with heredity, but no one really quite knew what they were or how that worked. And along come Watson and Crick figuring out that chromosomes are wound up DNA and that DNA has a spiral structure and learning to read the genetic code. And I'm going to use an analogy. If you'd never seen letters, if you'd never seen writing before, and you came upon a book or a dictionary even, and all it had was the letters. First of all, you would go through and you would identify how many different letters there were, 26, right, or 4 in the case of the genetic code. Then you'd start looking for patterns in the letters and trying to read genes. And so when we finally decoded or had the whole genome out there, we could say, okay, now we know all of the words in this book, but we don't know what the words mean yet. So now we're going to go and look at people who have a disease and they don't make something, and what's the word that's missing from their book? And then we're going to say, okay, well, if you don't have that word or you have a misspelling in that word, then that causes that disease. And we thought we'd have all the diseases decoded, but it didn't work. It turned out that a lot of people would have misspelled words and not be sick, and people would have different misspellings and have the same illness. Then with epigenetics, we realized that sometimes the words were covered up and couldn't be read. And now that we've got the whole genome decoding on multiple different people, so we're looking and comparing exactly what words, we discovered that it isn't so much the variation in the words themselves, but that we've got multiple words. So the word gets duplicated multiple times. And people vary a lot in terms of these duplications. So copy number variation is what this is called. And recently they ran a study of about 270 people, and they did all of their DNA, whole genome research, and they found copy number variations in 2,900 different genes, and large number of differences between one individual and another. Up to 12% of the variation between people would be these copy number variations. So this is going to turn out to be hugely important in disease. And I have here a paper that was recently published looking at copy number variation in ADHD. So all the research that's looking at, okay, is there a genetic cause for ADHD, in other words, hyperactivity disorder, that didn't find it. Now it turns out that there is a big difference in the number of copies. People with ADHD have 30% fewer copies of a certain line of DNA. They've also found something in Crohn's disease, a base pair deletion that is a reduced number of copies that is possibly responsible for 40% of Crohn's disease. So we're finding now that many of these diseases may not be differences in the genetics at the coding level, at the word level or the spelling level, but just in terms of having more or fewer copies of that word. And this is really interesting. It's also a little bit disheartening, actually, because it says that we've just got the tip of the iceberg here in figuring out how to predict disease or even diagnose disease with genetics. And it isn't going to be easy. It's getting more and more and more difficult and more complicated, which makes sense that it is very complicated, but it's also very disheartening in terms of being able to use this anytime in my lifetime for medical help. So some good news and some bad news from the realm of deep science. Those 26 letters in the alphabet are perhaps just even more complicated in the DNA. Let's go to Helen in Pacific Grove. Hello, Helen, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Dunn. Thank you so much for your program. My question is about calcium supplementation. I had read on consumerlab.com recently that an article published, I believe it was in the May of this year, British Medical Journal, stated that calcium supplementation caused calcification, vascular calcification. And I was wondering if you had any comments on that.
Well, yeah, I have a comment right away because you used the word caused, and you can't prove cause. It's certainly not in an epidemiologic study. And I do know that study, and they didn't take human guinea pigs, feed them calcium supplements, and then measure coronary calcium. It was a retrospective study looking at people's history of supplementation. So there's already some noise and some concerns there. Similar studies have been published in the past that show that calcium supplementations cause kidney stones. And then subsequently, when the data is really looked at prospectively, that association is lost. So there's a problem right there because you have something called recall bias. But let's get to the physiology here. If a person has plaque in their coronary arteries, the plaque that carries calcium in it is more dangerous because calcium is a mineral, and as you might expect, it tends to make the plaque more rigid. Rigid plaques are more likely to rupture, and when they rupture, they expose collagen to the bloodstream, and the platelets jump on that collagen and form a clot, and that can lead to a heart attack or a stroke. So we have an association with probability that if you have a plaque with calcium, you're more likely to have an event from that plaque. We often, in people who have a strong family history of heart disease and low cholesterol, a lot of alternative doctors or some of the cardiologists at the really advanced centers like Mayo Clinic and such will do a CT of the heart to look at calcium and do something called a calcium score. And statistically, if you have a high calcium score, you have a higher probability of having a heart attack or a stroke. So we do things like lower your cholesterol as much as we can and put you on aspirin, trying essentially to keep that from being your bad luck that you have the event. So I'm really skeptical about causality here. And I would totally agree that it's bad to have calcium in your coronary arteries, but I don't know that taking calcium supplements is going to cause that calcium to deposit. And I think it may be that in people who have a predisposition to develop this, and this is a maybe and this study does not demonstrate it, you would not want them taking more than a certain amount, say 1,000 milligrams. Do you know offhand, do you have the study there and know the doses of calcium that were used?
I do have the study in front of me, but...
Typically, if it's not in the abstract, then there isn't a specific dose that they looked at. That paragraph at the beginning, if you don't see blank milligrams, then probably there was a range of dosing and it's, you know, just a retrospective. But anyway, I'd say one study does not make a risk, and and I would still encourage people to be on calcium, preferably from dietary sources. But if you are going to take calcium supplements because you just can't eat dairy, for example, or have cholesterol issues and shouldn't have high fat, then I think 1,000 milligrams for males and premenopausal women and 1,500 milligrams for postmenopausal women still is the appropriate dose.
1,500 would be the appropriate dose for supplementation or for total calcium intake, including dietary?
Total calcium intake, and therefore, for each ounce of cheese or 8 ounces of dairy, you can subtract 250 milligrams from that.
Okay, good. That's very helpful. Thank you. I have a couple of other questions. I don't know if you have time.
Yeah, sure. We've got no one waiting, so you are
okay.
Up.
My husband has been successfully using your proton pump inhibitor, getting off.
Good.
And his question is how long he should stay with the regime.
Well, in general, it depends upon the duration that a person has had the problem. You want to give it about 6 months, and it depends on what aspect we're talking about. So, for example, part of what I have people do if they've been on proton pump inhibitors for more than a year is I have them use hydrochloric acid with their meals. And I definitely say continue that for at least 6 months, possibly a year. And the reasoning there is that it's going to take that long for the upregulation of the gastrin-producing cells, the parietal cells in the stomach, to go away. It's like causing a callus on the bottom of your foot. If you walk barefoot all the time and you'll get a callus, it's going to take, you know, you start wearing shoes, it's going to take 6 months for the calluses to all just go away. And they do go away because there's nothing stimulating them anymore. So eventually they slough off. And I use that 6 months as kind of a rule of thumb. And it's certainly fine to try stopping it earlier. In fact, most people do that accidentally once or twice anyway because they don't take their betaine because they're out or they forget and they get a little belching or heartburn, then you know you still need it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things. Some people need to stay on an H2 blocker at bedtime because they never get their lower esophageal sphincter to seal up completely. People with hiatal hernias, for example, I'll often have them be on something like a ranitidine, which is Zantac 75, forever. Just, it's like, okay, that's your bedtime dose because we don't want to get the cycle rolling again. And that isn't a strong enough drug to impair your vitamin absorption, your calcium and your B12, which is the concern long term with the very strong proton pump inhibitors, is that the body, for one thing, makes more acid producing cells. So your body's fighting back against the drug because the drug's so strong. And the other thing is that meanwhile, while you're suppressing all that acid, the risk of pneumonia goes up and the risk of vitamin deficiencies that could lead to both Alzheimer's and neuropathy and osteoporosis goes up.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't really want to push the body that hard.
And the hydrochloric acid, is that the betaine HCl?
That's right. That's the betaine HCl.
Okay, great.
And just for the audience, if you are wanting this how to get off proton pump inhibitor information, it is available on the website, or you can send a self-addressed stamped envelope to this station, and I'll send it back to you.
Okay. I have one more question, if you're willing to.
That's just fine, Helen. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. My husband just handed me one other thing. As far as the acid reducer goes that he is taking, the milder one, I guess, that you recommended, is it 150 or 75 milligrams that he should be taking?
Initially, it's 150, and then okay. For maintenance, it's what works, one or two.
Right. Okay. And that's the bedtime thing. Okay,
yes.
Great. Okay, excellent. My other question has to do with hormone replacement therapy, which I have been on for some time. And, of course, reports keep coming out about the breast cancer thing, but you know, they keep periodically putting out saying that it's increasing breast cancer. But I have stayed on it based on some information that I've heard from you and other people that say that maybe the studies are flawed. My question is about estrogen metabolism. I understand that there are two pathways through which estrogen can be metabolized and that one of them is better than the other. And
right.
I believe there's a test for that. And then the other thing is with respect to this is that you mentioned the indole 3 carbinol, and I'm wondering about that and if one were to take it, what the dosages would be.
Okay. All right. So estrogen metabolism. You have a number of enzymatic steps that take estrogen through the liver, and there is a two-step dance whenever you break down a drug or a hormone or a plant compound or anything, basically, that gets broke down has to be activated to be eliminated by the body. And most things are activated by the liver in what's called phase one detoxification, by the addition of a hydroxy, an oxygen-hydrogen group. And that gets enzymatically hooked on somewhere to the molecule. And I like the analogy of putting a jump ring on a piece, something that you intend to use for an earring or a necklace or a bracelet. You're going to put a solder a jump ring on it so that you can attach it. Now, once you've put that hydroxy group on there, this compound is reactive. It wants to react with other compounds. So phase two detoxification is in a controlled fashion making that reaction happen with a compound like glycine or acetate or a sulfur compound that forms a complex, the chemical, the jump ring, and this lead weight that's going to allow it to sit in bile, be dumped into the intestine from the biliary tract, stay in the intestine, and be pooped out. And that's how we get rid of a great many things. During the period that you are breaking down compounds, the first phase reaction, phase one detoxification of estrogen, can put the hydroxy group at either the 2', the 4' positions. If it gets put on the 4', it gets broken down again and it has an hydroxy at the 16'. So you could think of the 16' as a breakdown product of the 4'. And the 2' is not reactive with DNA, and the 4' is reactive with DNA. The 4' will actually go to DNA, and because estrogen penetrates into the nucleus, and this hydroxyestrogen can still penetrate into the nucleus of the cell, it can actually attach to DNA and form what's called an adduct, A-D-D-U-C-T. And this irreversible DNA adduct is essentially an epigenetic change to DNA. And if it happens to go into a place where there's a oncogene, in other words, a growth suppressor gene, you can turn off a growth suppressor and mutate the DNA in the direction of cancer. So this is why we don't like to have high levels of the 4' hydroxyestrogen. And you can measure that in the blood, but it's typically done in urine because these are excreted in the urine as well. So the ratio of 2 to 4 or 2 to 16, and I do the 2 to 16 ratio because it's good enough for clinical purposes and it's cheaper and more accurate. At this point, our accuracy on the 4 is, it's tough to do, but 16 is easy to do. So I just use the 16 as a surrogate marker. And if a person has high levels of 16 compared to their 2, regardless of whether they're taking estrogen or not, I'll have them eat a lot of broccoli, cruciferous vegetables. And yes, you can go on DMT or indole-3-carbinol. And, you know, the doses are like 300 to 400 milligrams for most of these. And I'm not sure how well established those doses are, but anecdotally, that's, you know, how they're available. And then you recheck the breakdown products and you look, you wait a month, and then you check again another urine test and see how the liver is metabolizing. See if you've shifted the metabolism in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I approach it.
What is the name of the test if I wanted to request that from my physician?
Various labs have different names for it. It's an estrogen metabolism profile, urinary 2:16 ratio.
Mm-hmm.
So your doctor may have to do a little digging if they haven't heard of this test, but
yeah,
customer service people at any lab will tell you how to get it.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Let's go to Bob in Santa Cruz. Hello, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've been taking Poperol 25 milligrams a day for over a year, and I'm going to be taking it, I guess, the rest of my life. I have a defibrillator, and they're using it to control my adrenaline. And I wonder if there's any long-term impact of that particular medication on my system.
Tell me a little bit more about why you're on the Toprol. You said you have a pacemaker, and it's being...
Yeah, okay. So I have ventricular tachycardia. I had a silent heart attack a number of years ago. It wasn't noticed until, you know, I took a treadmill test, and something was going on that was a little odd. And anyway, the investigation came up with... had a little bit of scarring in my heart from this heart attack, but that basically the danger is the ventricular tachycardia.
Have you actually had VTAC?
I had one after the defibrillator was installed.
Okay, so basically they put a device in your chest to control something that you hadn't yet had, and in doing so perturbed the system sufficiently to actually trigger the event. By the way, implantable defibrillator pacemakers are all the rage now, and I think that sometimes the indications for them are, I'm not going to try to second-guess your doctor, but I do think that they're overused at the moment. But once it's in, it's in. Okay, so your question is really about the metoprolol. Metoprolol lowers cardiac irritability because it's a beta blocker, and it also has some effect on lowering blood pressure and lowering stroke volume. So it kind of relaxes the heart muscle. Heart doesn't beat quite as hard. It also stabilizes the nerve aspect of the heart muscle. Heart muscle is a very odd kind of muscle. It's half muscle, half nerve. These cells can actually generate an action potential all on their own, which most muscle cells can't do. And the pacemakers in your heart, they're muscle cells that are even further in the direction of being a nerve cell, and so they generate an action potential that acts as the clock for the heart. When there isn't good blood flow or when there's scar tissue that's stretching one of the muscles, for example, that muscle fiber can start generating action potentials, and that can lead to the ventricular tachycardia.
Right.
So the idea of putting the pacemaker in, pacemaker defibrillator, was really to get the defibrillator in. And therefore, if you do go into VTAC, it shocks you and defibrillates you.
Correct.
Right. So that was more for the audience. So the idea of the Toprol is to prevent your heart from going into VTAC so you don't need to be defibrillated. So you've kind of got a belt and suspenders approach, which is very typical. Now, as to the long-term effects of Toprol, it lowers blood pressure. It can affect your erections. It does have some anti-adrenergic effect in the brain. So some people will have statistically increased risk of depression, increased fatigue, sometimes mental slowing. It's all about the dosing. If I give you enough beta blocker, you'll have all of those side effects. But the amounts that we typically use for your purpose would be 25 to 50 milligrams. And one is unlikely to see those sorts of side effects at that dose.
Yeah, I haven't noticed any of those.
Yeah, that being said, if you developed any of those symptoms, I would probably take you off of your beta blocker slowly, with the idea that you've got the defibrillator and we don't really even know if you're going to trigger because you hadn't triggered until they, you know, basically operated on your heart. So you probably could get by with just the defibrillator if you were having something adverse to your quality of life. And I think that's really important to put out there. I want to empower patients. I want to empower all my listeners as patients to say to their doctor, look, I would rather have a good quality of life and I will take this risk and you are absolved from, you know, you've told me that this is a risk. Like, for example, somebody who gets body aches from statins, don't take the statin.
Right.
You know, take the risk of the heart attack. It's not that big a risk. If you haven't had a heart attack, you're better off exercising in terms of your long-term benefit than taking the statin that makes your muscles hurt so you don't exercise. And that's just an example of how we can, in our desire to reduce risk, we can actually paradoxically make the person less healthy.
Yeah.
So we got to watch that one.
Yeah, well, I was saying, you know, I had the defibrillator implanted, and then 5 months later is when I had the shock from a, I guess, you know, I was almost fainted, and then it shocked me, and then that was, I didn't die, which was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then the other question is, they're trying to control my cholesterol as well. My cholesterol count is about 120 normally.
I'm sorry, 120, you said?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. My doctor's been wanting it down around 70. And so, mm-hmm. You know, I've been taking a little bit of Lipitor for that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, like 5 milligrams, like every other day or something, barely any at all. And it stays down right around 70. You know, I'm just wondering about taking, and it's at 120 already anyway. Why am I having to get it down around 70?
Okay, well, I can definitely answer that. The reason is because you already had a heart attack.
Right.
And so you've got, besides the cholesterol, you've got other things in your system. Maybe you've got copy number variations. Maybe you've got genetic variations. Maybe you've got epigenetic changes. But you've got other drivers that gave you a heart attack, or gave you plaque, which gave you a heart attack. So what they're trying to do is get your plaque as flat and as uncrackable as possible so that you don't have another heart attack. And we know that if we get the LDL below 100, we start to see shrinkage of the plaque. It's very slow, like, you know, 1% a year. But as the plaque shrinks, it also gets less likely to crack. And so shrinking plaque, even if it's shrinking very slowly, is much safer plaque to have. And we know you have plaque because you had a heart attack, QED. We don't need to go any further there. So that's the logic. The number 70 is not science-based. The number 70 is more like a good compromise in that we see the shrinkage. We don't want to drive it much lower because you do need a certain amount of cholesterol to make your hormones. And we don't want to eliminate cholesterol from your body totally. So it's a good compromise number. So it's become the official goal. And I shouldn't say it's not science-based. It's somewhat science-based. It's very difficult to establish that it shouldn't be 75 or 65 or something like that. The precision just isn't there in terms of that number. So I'd be satisfied with 80 or in a patient. I wouldn't, you know, do anything to get them from 80 to 70 with the assumption that I was actually causing much benefit. But in your case, it's because of your history.
Right.
That's why.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, and I'm glad that I misunderstood about your defibrillator. I thought that it triggered when they were putting it in, not six months later. So, you know, it sounds like they were correct in putting that in you. So
the first 5 months there, I didn't want to take the Toprol. So, you know, my doctor said, well, you know, it's your call. And then after I had that experience, I thought, well, you know, I think I'll take Tocopherol.
Yeah, it's not so pleasant to have that defibrillator trigger.
No.
It's really not. It's really not. It's like somebody just gave you a karate chop to the sternum. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. Bye-bye. We've come to another hour. Time to go, but I hope you've enjoyed this as much as I have, and I hope you'll join me next week for more science, more discussion, more healthcare topics. It's all here on Ask Dr. Don. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.